23. Nately's old man. The only one back in the squadron who did see any of Milo's red bananas was Arfie, who picked up two from an influential fraternity brother of his in the Quartermaster Corps when the bananas ripened and began streaming into Italy through normal black market channels, and who is in the officer's apartment with Yossarian the evening Nately finally found his whore again after so many fruitless weeks of mournful searching, and lured her back to the apartment with two girlfriends by promising them $30 each.
$30 each?
Remarked Arfie slowly, poking and patting each of the three strapping girls skeptically with the air of a grudging connoisseur.
$30 is a lot of money for pieces like these. Besides, I never paid for it in my life.
I'm not asking you to pay for it, Nately assured him quickly. I'll pay for them all. I just want you guys to take the other two. Won't you help me out?
Arfie smirked complacently and shook his soft, round head.
Nobody has to pay for it for good old Arfie. I can get all I want anytime I want. I'm just not in the mood right now. Why don't you just pay all three and send the other two away?
Yossarian suggested.
Because then mine will be angry with me for making her work for her money,
Nately replied with an anxious look at his girl, who was glowering at him restlessly and starting to mutter.
She says that if I really liked her, I'd send her away and go to bed with one of the others.
I have a better idea, boasted Arfie. Why don't we keep the three of them here until after the curfew and then threaten to push them out into the street to be arrested unless they give us all their money? We can even threaten to push them out the window.
Arfie?
Nately was aghast.
Well, I was only trying to help, said Arfie sheepishly.
Arfie was always trying to help Nately, because Nately's father was rich and prominent and in an excellent position to help Arfie after the war.
Gee whiz, he defended himself querulously. Back in school, we were always doing things like that. I remember one day we tricked these two dumb high school girls from town into the fraternity house and made them put out for all the fellows who were there who wanted them by threatening to call up their parents and say they were putting out for us. We kept them trapped in bed there for more than 10 hours. We even smacked their faces a little when they started to complain. Then we took away their nickels and dimes and chewing gum and threw them out. Boy, we used to have fun in that fraternity house, he recalled peacefully, his corpulent cheeks aglow with the jovial, rubicund warmth of nostalgic recollection. We used to ostracize everyone, even each other.
But Arfie was no help to Nately now, as the girl Nately had fallen so deeply in love with began swearing at him sullenly with rising, menacing resentment. Luckily, Hungry Joe burst in just then, and everything was all right again, except that Dunbar staggered in drunk a minute later and began embracing one of the other giggling girls at once. Now there were four men and three girls, and the seven of them left Arfie in the apartment and climbed into a horse-drawn cab, which remained at the curb at a dead halt while the girls demanded their money in advance. Nately gave them $90 with a gallant flourish after borrowing $20 from Yossarian, $35 from Dunbar, and $17 from Hungry Joe. The girls grew friendlier then and called an address to the driver, who drove them at a clopping pace halfway across the city into a section they had never visited before, and stopped in front of an old, tall building on a dark street. The girls led them up four steep, very long flights of creaking wooden stairs and guided them through a doorway into their own wonderful and resplendent tenement apartment, which burgeoned miraculously with an infinite and proliferating flow of supple young naked girls and contained the evil and debauched ugly old man who irritated Nately constantly with his caustic laughter, and the clucking, proper old woman in the ash-gray woolen sweater who disapproved of everything immoral that occurred there and tried her best to tidy up. The amazing place was a fertile, seething cornucopia of female nipples and navels. At first, there were just their own three girls in the dimly lit, drab-brown sitting room that stood at the juncture of three murky hallways leading in separate directions to the distant recesses of the strange and marvelous bordello. The girls disrobed at once, pausing in different stages to point proudly to their garish underthings and bantering all the while with the gaunt and dissipated old man with the shabby long white hair and slovenly white unbuttoned shirt, who sat cackling lasciviously in a musty blue armchair almost in the exact center of the room and bade Nately and his companions welcome with a mirthful and sardonic formality. Then the old woman trudged out to get a girl for Hungry Joe, dipping her captious head sadly, and returned with two big-bosomed beauties, one already undressed and the other in only a transparent pink half-slip that she wiggled out of while sitting down. Three more naked girls sauntered in from a different direction and remained to chat, then two others. Four more girls passed through the room in an indolent group, engrossed in conversation. Three were barefoot, and one wobbled perilously on a pair of unbuckled silver dancing shoes that did not seem to be her own. One more girl appeared, wearing only panties, and sat down, bringing the total congregating there just in a few minutes to 11, all but one of them completely unclothed. There was bare flesh lounging everywhere, most of it plump, and Hungry Joe began to die. He stood stock still in rigid cataleptic astonishment while the girls ambled in and made themselves comfortable. Then he let out a piercing shriek suddenly and bolted toward the door in a headlong dash back toward the enlisted men's apartment for his camera, only to be halted in his tracks with another frantic shriek by the dreadful, freezing premonition that this whole lovely, lurid, rich, and colorful pagan paradise would be snatched away from him irredeemably if he were to let it out of his sight for even an instant. He stopped in the doorway and sputtered, the wiry veins and tendons in his face and neck pulsating violently. The old man watched him with victorious merriment, sitting in his musty blue armchair like some satanic and hedonistic deity on a throne, a stolen U.S. Army blanket wrapped around his spindly legs to ward off a chill. He laughed quietly, his sunken, shrewd eyes sparkling perceptively with a cynical and wanton enjoyment. He had been drinking. Nately reacted on sight with bristling enmity to this wicked, depraved, and unpatriotic old man who was old enough to remind him of his father and who made disparaging jokes about America.
"America," he said, "will lose the war, and Italy will win it."
"America is the strongest and most prosperous nation on earth," Nately informed him with lofty fervor and dignity, "and the American fighting man is second to none."
"Exactly,"
agreed the old man pleasantly with a hint of taunting amusement.
"Italy, on the other hand, is one of the least prosperous nations on earth. An Italian fighting man is probably second to all. And that's exactly why my country is doing so well in this war, while your country is doing so poorly."
Nately guffawed with surprise, then blushed apologetically for his impoliteness.
"I'm sorry I laughed at you," he said sincerely, and he continued with a tone of respectful condescension. "But Italy was occupied by the Germans and is now being occupied by us. You don't call that doing very well, do you?"
"But of course I do,"
exclaimed the old man cheerfully.
"The Germans are being driven out, and we are still here. In a few years, you will be gone too, and we will still be here. You see, Italy is really a very poor and weak country, and that's what makes us so strong. Italian soldiers are not dying anymore, but American and German soldiers are. I call that doing extremely well. Yes, I'm quite certain that Italy will survive this war and still be in existence long after your own country has been destroyed."
Nately could scarcely believe his ears. He had never heard such shocking blasphemies before, and he wondered with instinctive logic why G-Men did not appear to lock the traitorous old man up.
"America's not going to be destroyed," he shouted passionately.
"Never?"
prodded the old man softly.
"Well,"
Nately faltered. The old man laughed indulgently, holding in check a deeper, more explosive delight. His goading remained gentle.
"Rome was destroyed. Greece was destroyed. Persia was destroyed. Spain was destroyed. All great countries are destroyed. Why not yours? How much longer do you really think your country will last? Forever? Keep in mind that the Earth itself is destined to be destroyed by the sun in 25 million years or so.
Nately squirmed uncomfortably.
Well, forever's a long time, I guess. 1 million years?
Persisted the jeering old man with keen, sadistic jest.
500,000? The frog is almost 500 million years old. Could you really say with much certainty that America, with all its strength and prosperity, with its fighting men that is second to none, with its standard of living that is the highest in the world, will last as long as the frog?
Nately wanted to smash his leering face. He looked about, imploring for help in defending his country's future against the obnoxious calumnies of this sly and sinful assailant. He was disappointed. Yossarian and Dunbar were busy in a far corner, pawing orgiastically at 4 or 5 frolicsome girls and 6 bottles of red wine, and Hungry Joe had long since tramped away down one of the mystic hallways, propelling before him like a ravening despot as many of the broadest-hipped young prostitutes as he could contain in his frail windmilling arms and cram into one double bed. Nately felt himself at an embarrassing loss. His own girl sat sprawled out gracelessly on an overstuffed sofa with an expression of otiose boredom. Nately was unnerved by her torpid indifference to him, by the same sleepy and inert pose that he remembered so vividly, so sweetly, and so miserably from the first time she had seen him and ignored him at the packed penny-ante blackjack game in the living room of the enlisted men's apartment. Her lax mouth hung open in a perfect O, and God alone knew at what her glazed and smoky eyes were staring in such brute apathy. The old man waited tranquilly, watching him with a discerning smile that was both scornful and sympathetic. A lissom, blonde, sinuous girl with lovely legs and honey-colored skin laid herself out contentedly on the arm of the old man's chair and began molesting his angular, pale, dissolute face languidly and coquettishly. Nately stiffened with resentment and hostility at the sight of such lechery in a man so old. He turned away with a sinking heart and wondered why he simply did not take his own girl and go to bed. This sordid, vulturous, diabolical old man reminded Nately of his father because the two were nothing at all alike. Nately's father was a courtly, white-haired gentleman who dressed impeccably. This old man was an uncouth bum. Nately's father was a sober, philosophical, and responsible man. This old man was fickle and licentious. Nately's father was discreet and cultured. This old man was a bore. Nately's father believed in honor and knew the answer to everything. This old man believed in nothing and had only questions. Nately's father had a distinguished white mustache. This old man had no mustache at all. Nately's father, and everyone else's father Nately had ever met, was dignified, wise, and venerable. This old man was utterly repellent, and Nately plunged back into the debate with him, determined to repudiate his vile logic and insinuations with an ambitious vengeance that would capture the attention of the bored, phlegmatic girl he had fallen so intensely in love with and win her admiration forever.
"Well, frankly, I don't know how long America's going to last," he proceeded dauntlessly. "I suppose we can't last forever if the world itself is going to be destroyed someday. But I do know that we're going to survive and triumph for a long, long time."
"For how long?"
mocked the profane old man with a gleam of malicious elation.
"Not even as long as the frog?"
"Much longer than you or me,"
Nately blurted out lamely.
"Oh, is that all? That won't be very much longer then, considering that you're so gullible and brave, and that I am already such an old, old man."
"How old are you?"
Nately asked, growing intrigued and charmed with the old man in spite of himself.
107.
The old man chuckled heartily at Nately's look of chagrin.
I see you don't believe that either.
I don't believe anything you tell me, Nately replied with a bashful, mitigating smile. The only thing I do believe is that America is going to win the war.
You put so much stock in winning wars,
the grubby, iniquitous old man scoffed.
The real trick lies in losing wars, in knowing which wars can be lost. Italy has been a losing wars for centuries, and just see how splendidly we've done nonetheless. France wins wars and is in a continual state of crisis. Germany loses and it prospers. Look at our own recent history. Italy won a war in Ethiopia and promptly stumbled into serious trouble. Victory gave us such insane delusions of grandeur that we helped start a world war we hadn't a chance of winning. But now that we're losing again, everything has taken a turn for the better, and we will certainly come out on top again if we succeed in being defeated.
Nately gaped at him in undisguised befuddlement.
Now I really don't understand what you're saying. You talk like a madman.
But I live like a sane one. I was a fascist when Mussolini was on top, and I am an anti-fascist now that he has been deposed. I was fanatically pro-German when the Germans were here to protect us against the Americans. And now that the Americans are here to protect us against the Germans, I am fanatically pro-American. I can assure you, my outraged young friend,
the old man's knowing, disdainful eyes shone even more effervescently as Nately's stuttering dismay increased,
that you and your country will have no more loyal partisan in Italy than me, but only as long as you remain in Italy.
But, Nately cried out in disbelief, you're a turncoat, a time server, a shameful, unscrupulous opportunist.
I am 107 years old,
the old man reminded him suavely.
Don't you have any principles?
Of course not.
No morality?
Oh, I am a very moral man,
the villainous old man assured him with satiric seriousness, stroking the bare hip of a buxom black-haired girl with pretty dimples who had stretched herself out seductively on the other arm of his chair. He grinned at Nately sarcastically as he sat between both naked girls in smug and threadbare splendor, with a sovereign hand on each.
I can't believe it,
Nately remarked grudgingly, trying stubbornly not to watch him in relationship to the girls.
I simply can't believe it.
But it's all perfectly true. When the Germans marched into the city, I danced in the streets like a youthful ballerina and shouted, Heil Hitler, until my lungs were hoarse. I even waved a small Nazi flag that I had snatched away from a beautiful little girl while her mother was looking the other way. When the Germans left the city, I rushed out to welcome the Americans with a bottle of excellent brandy and a basket of flowers. The brandy was for myself, of course, and the flowers were to sprinkle upon our liberators. There's a very stiff and stuffy old major riding in the first car, and I hit him squarely in the eye with a red rose. A marvelous shot. You should have seen him wince.
Nately gasped and was on his feet with amazement, the blood draining from his cheeks.
Major de Coverley, he cried.
Do you know him?
Inquired the old man with delight.
What a charming coincidence!
Nately was too astonished even to hear him.
So you're the one who wounded Major de Coverley, he exclaimed in horrified indignation. How could you do such a thing?
The fiendish old man was unperturbed.
Oh, could I resist, you mean? You should have seen the arrogant old boar sitting there so sternly in that car like the Almighty himself, with his big, rigid head and his foolish, solemn face. What a tempting target he made. I got him in the eye with an American Beauty rose. I thought that was most appropriate. Don't you?
That was a terrible thing to do, Nately shouted at him reproachfully. A vicious and criminal thing. Major de Coverley is our squadron executive officer.
Is he?
Teased the unregenerate old man, pinching his pointy jaw gravely in a parody of repentance.
In that case, you must give me credit for being impartial. When the Germans rode in, I almost stabbed a robust young Oberleutnant to death with a sprig of Edelweiss.
Nately was appalled and bewildered by the abominable old man's inability to perceive the enormity of his offense.
"Don't you realize what you've done?" he scolded vehemently. "Major de Coverley is a noble and wonderful person, and everyone admires him."
"He is a silly old fool who really has no right acting like a silly young fool. Where is he today? Dead?"
Nately answered softly with somber awe.
"Nobody knows. He seems to have disappeared."
"You see, imagine a man his age risking what little life he has left for something so absurd as a country."
Nately was instantly up in arms again.
"There's nothing so absurd about risking your life for your country," he declared.
"Isn't there?" asked the old man. "What is a country? A country is a piece of land surrounded on all sides by boundaries, usually unnatural. Englishmen are dying for England. Americans are dying for America. Germans are dying for Germany. Russians are dying for Russia. There are now 50 or 60 countries fighting in this war. Surely so many countries can't all be worth dying for."
"Anything worth living for," said Nately, "is worth dying for."
"And anything worth dying for," answered the sacrilegious old man, "is certainly worth living for. You know, you're such a pure and naive young man that I almost feel sorry for you. How old are you? 25, 26?
19, said Nately. "I'll be 20 in January."
"If you live."
The old man shook his head, wearing for a moment the same touchy, meditating frown of the fretful and disapproving old woman.
"They're going to kill you if you don't watch out. And I can see now you're not going to watch out. Why don't you use some sense and try to be more like me? You might live to be 107, too."
"Because it's better to die on one's feet than live on one's knee,"
Nately retorted with triumphant and lofty conviction. "I guess you've never heard that saying before."
"Yes, I certainly have,"
mused the treacherous old man, smiling again.
"But I'm afraid you have it backward. It is better to live on one's feet than to die on one's knees. That is the way the saying goes."
Are you sure?" Nately asked with sober confusion. "It seems to make more sense my way."
"No, it makes more sense my way. Ask your friends."
Nately turned to ask his friends and discovered they had gone. Yossarian and Dunbar had both disappeared. The old man roared with contemptuous merriment at Nately's look of embarrassed surprise. Nately's face darkened with shame. He vacillated helplessly for a few seconds and then spun himself around and fled inside the nearest of the hallways in search of Yossarian and Dunbar, hoping to catch them in time and bring them back to the rescue with news of the remarkable clash between the old man and Major de Coverley. All the doors in all the hallways were shut. There was light under none. It was already very late. Nately gave up his search forlornly. There was nothing left for him to do, he realized finally, but get the girl he was in love with and lie down with her somewhere to make tender, courteous love to her and plan their future together. But she had gone off to bed, too, by the time he returned to the sitting room for her, and there was nothing left for him to do then but resume his abortive discussion with the loathsome old man, who rose from his armchair with jesting civility and excused himself for the night, abandoning Nately there with two bleary-eyed girls who could not tell him into which room his own horror had gone, and who padded off to bed several seconds later after trying in vain to interest him in themselves, leaving him to sleep alone in the sitting room on the small, lumpy sofa. Nately was a sensitive, rich, good-looking boy with dark hair, trusting eyes, and a pain in his neck when he awoke on the sofa early the next morning and wondered dully where he was. His nature was invariably gentle and polite. He had lived for almost 20 years without trauma, tension, hate, or neurosis, which was proof to Yossarian of just how crazy he really was. His childhood had been a pleasant, though disciplined one. He got on well with his brothers and sisters, and he did not hate his mother and father, even though they had both been very good to him. Nately had been brought up to detest people like Arfie, whom his mother characterized as climbers, and people like Milo, whom his father characterized as pushers, but he had never learned how, since he had never been permitted near them. As far back as he could recall, his homes in Philadelphia, New York, Maine, Palm Beach, Southampton, London, Deauville, Paris, and the south of France had always been crowded only with ladies and gentlemen who were not climbers or pushers. Nately's mother, a descendant of the New England Thorntons, was a daughter of the American Revolution. His father was a son of a bitch. "Always remember," his mother had reminded him frequently, "that you are a Nately. You're not a Vanderbilt whose fortune was made by a vulgar tugboat captain, or a Rockefeller whose wealth was amassed through unscrupulous speculations in crude petroleum, or a Reynolds or Duke whose income was derived from the sale to the unsuspecting public of products containing cancer-causing resins and tars. And you are certainly not an Astor, whose family, I believe, still lets rooms. You are a Nately, and the Natelys have never done anything for their money." "What your mother means, son," interjected his father affably one time with that flair for graceful and economical expression Nately admired so much, "is that old money is better than new money, and that the newly rich are never to be esteemed as highly as the newly poor. Isn't that correct, my dear?" Nately's father brimmed continually with sage and sophisticated counsel of that kind. He was as ebullient and ruddy as mulled claret, and Nately liked him a great deal, although he did not like mulled claret. When war broke out, Nately's family decided that he would enlist in the armed forces, since he was too young to be placed in the diplomatic service, and since his father had it on excellent authority that Russia was going to collapse in a matter of weeks or months, and that Hitler, Churchill, Roosevelt, Mussolini, Gandhi, Franco, Peron, and the Emperor of Japan would then all sign a peace treaty and live happily ever after. It was Nately's father's idea that he join the Air Corps, where he could train safely as a pilot while the Russians capitulated and the details of the armistice were worked out, and where, as an officer, he would associate only with gentlemen. Instead, he found himself with Yossarian, Dunbar, and Hungry Joe in a whorehouse in Rome, poignantly in love with an indifferent girl there with whom he finally did lie down the morning after the night he slept alone in the sitting room, only to be interrupted almost immediately by her incorrigible kid sister, who came bursting in without warning and hurled herself onto the bed jealously so that Nately could embrace her, too. Nately's whore sprang up snarling to whack her angrily and jerked her to her feet by the hair. The 12-year-old girl looked to Nately like a plucked chicken, or like a twig with the bark peeled off. Her sapling body embarrassed everyone in her precocious attempts to imitate her elders, and she was always being chased away to put clothes on and ordered out into the street to play in the fresh air with the other children. The two sisters swore and spat at each other now savagely, raising a fluent, deafening commotion that brought a whole crowd of hilarious spectators swarming into the room. Nately gave up in exasperation. He asked his girl to get dressed and took her downstairs for breakfast. The kid's sister tagged along, and Nately felt like the proud head of a family as the three of them ate respectably in a nearby open-air cafe. But Nately's whore was already bored by the time they started back, and she decided to go streetwalking with two other girls rather than spend more time with him. Nately and the kid's sister followed meekly a block behind, the ambitious youngster to pick up valuable pointers, Nately to eat his liver in mooning frustration, and both were saddened when the girls were stopped by soldiers in a staff car and driven away. Nately went back to the cafe and bought the kid's sister chocolate ice cream until her spirits improved, and then returned with her to the apartment, where Yossarian and Dunbar were flopped out in the sitting room with an exhausted, hungry Joe, who was still wearing on his battered face the blissful, numb, triumphant smile with which he had limped into view from his massive harem that morning, like a person with numerous broken bones. The lecherous and depraved old man was delighted with Hungry Joe's split lips and black and blue eyes. He greeted Nately warmly, still wearing the same rumpled clothes of the evening before. Nately was profoundly upset by his seedy and disreputable appearance, and whenever he came to the apartment, he wished that the corrupt, immoral old man would put on a clean Brooks Brothers shirt, shave, comb his hair, wear a tweed jacket and grow a dapper white mustache, so that Nately would not have to suffer such confusing shame each time he looked at him and was reminded of his father.